You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Due to technical difficulties, this program begins about 5 minutes in. The first interview is with Elizabeth Morrow, author of Casualties. During the second half, T. Jefferson Parker, author of Crazy Blood. Thanks for listening. I think what makes Casualties a bit different is that, you know, in beginning the book, it seems as if it's going to be Robbie's story. And as we go on, it's really the mother Ruth's story. And I was so curious whether you knew that going in, if how much you knew about the book going in, because, you know, as it turns into Ruth's story, I'm reminded of something John Gardner said, which is all books are either about a stranger coming to town or a person going on a journey. And a little bit of both here happens, but it's really about Ruth's journey.
And, you know, I wouldn't say I knew exactly that going in. I would say that the journey portion of the piece was always there. But I had sort of been working on the novel for several years and sat down one day and threw out 600 pages and distilled it down to what led up to the journey and her arrival at the end. I finally had a last scene and line that I knew I was aiming for. So I think I understood, not right at the beginning, but the very end, that it was a journey story. It does seem to be in the beginning. It's really a story that begins between mother and son, and it's what happens between them and then what happens after that triggers the journey. So there is that shift.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's hear you read. This would be a great time to hear you read from Casualties.
Okay, what the section I'm going to read from is from the very first chapter when Ruth, who is a successful defense executive, single mom, worked very hard all her life, has plans for her son. He arrives home day after his birthday celebration was supposed to happen and tells her he's got very different plans. Robbie's chin still juts out as though he's expecting trouble, but he's searching for her face, the way he used to when he was a boy and wanted to see if he'd pleased her. He starts over, speaking slowly, deliberately, as if each word is loaded with explosives and must be uttered with care. I said, I decided to work for Uncle Sam. Kind of like you, only I joined the Marines. Signed on the dotted line last Friday. A couple of months, and I'm out of here. Ruth feels a sudden slipping inside, even though she can't move. That's impossible. Robbie's eyes harden, and he smirks again. They want me. A few good men, you know. Guess I'm good enough for once. Besides, there's a war on. But you know all that, right? He rubs the tips of his thumb and forefinger together and imitates the sound of a cash register. Cha-ching! Ruth grips the chair in front of her. She wants him to take it all back, the announcement he made so proudly and now his insulting tone that makes her job sound dirty. The military couldn't run their wars without the civilians she found for them. She helped men and women make money they needed, more than they could ever make doing the same jobs at home. But they were adults, not 19-year-old kids. No, she says. Robbie shrugs, but his eyes stay focused on hers. Not your call. For once, I'm doing what I want to do. I'll tell them the truth and they'll kick you out. Ruth has no idea if this is true, but she'll try anything. What are you talking about? Ruthless ticks off a list on her fingers. You flunked out of school after school. Rehab was the only thing that kept you out of juvie. What about the psychiatrist, your depression? Do the Marines know about all that? Got my GED and that other stuff's been over for years. 2 years, barely 2 years. Long enough. You could go to college. It's not too late. All you have to do is, when are you going to give up on that? Your kid's not college material, Ruthie. I'm just a motorhead who wants to beat up a few bad guys and spread freedom. Each word out of his mouth seems to put more distance between them. Ruth has to stop him. She has to find some way to fix this. And then he speaks. You think what I'm doing is stupid, don't you? Ruth hears him, but she's running through her mental Rolodex for the name of anyone who is connected, who can help her get him out. Then she realizes if she tries that, she'll be marked as the carpetbagger she's always felt she is. The company she works for is filled with ex-military. Proud is what she's supposed to feel. Proud is what they will expect of her. Too late, she registers his question, and helpless, she sees his hurt before he tries to look tough again. No, not stupid, she wants to say. You're all I have. Think about it, Ruthie, Robbie is saying now, leaning against the refrigerator. You'll be the mother of a Marine. For the first time ever, you can brag about me a little if you want. Words Ruth has been meaning to say for years crowd into her throat. Stop calling me that. What? Ruthie, I'm your mother. Don't forget it. She's crying. She expects him to look away. It's what he's done the few times she's ever cried in front of him. But he doesn't. He straightens and takes a step toward her. When he speaks again, all the mockery is gone. I'm doing this because I have to, Mom. Be proud of me. Just give it a try, okay? She understands that he means to sound tough, final. But Ruth hears the uncertainty he's trying to hide. She hears it, and in a flash of instinct, understands that he is asking her not to hear it. He's put himself out of reach. The balance between them has shifted. Then, through the tears, through the loss threatening to engulf her, Ruth feels something that frightens, but also exhilarates her. She is relieved. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. That was Elizabeth Morrow reading from Casualties, published by Berkeley. So, how much research did you have to do, either before writing the book, during writing, and which is another sort of interesting aspect to talk about. When does research stop and writing mm-hmm. begin?
Well, for me, it began at the beginning, but I was also writing while I was researching. I would say that there were, I think once I understood that this was the setting for the story and this was the world it was going to take place in, I knew I needed to learn a lot. So I would work on character issues. I would work on the story sort of itself. But to really do it, understand I had to sort of immerse myself as well in everything I could find about that world. And interestingly, at that time, it was in the early 2000s, in 2003, 2004, there were all, I think, sources that weren't typically available in previous years. Lots of things to read. Google is a writer's best friend, right? You can go anywhere on Google. You can look at maps. You could look at this. There's everything. However, what was also very interesting is that many of the military members who were deployed were also maintaining at that point, MySpace was very popular. Still, and so they were maintaining MySpace pages. They were maintaining blogs, very interesting blogs, very real blogs, where they would talk about what they could. And then, of course, that, after a few years, changed. Some of the blogs were taken down, but a lot of that material was still out there. And about that same time, we began to have people coming home. And there were then more writing happening, more memoirs, more interviews. There were organizations like Winter Soldier did many, many interviews and had actual word from the actual soldiers themselves and Marines and the others involved. So I immersed myself in anything I could read. I also, over time, found myself going and gravitating to places where I could be among the people that I was trying to write about. I stopped short, and I don't know, this may be an unusual decision, but because I'm no longer a journalist, I was writing a novel. I stopped short at that early stage of sitting down and asking a returning veteran, potentially with some issues that might be very painful for him to discuss or her to discuss, to share with me in an interview situation. Something I would not necessarily have hesitated to do as a journalist, I hesitated to do as a novelist, because at that moment, at that point in my writing, I wasn't sure how that would feel for either one of us. But there was also a plus side to that. It forced me to really notice and pick up almost through osmosis. When I was sitting, for example, in a Veterans for Peace presentation next to several young veterans newly returned, I was able to observe and hear things that you wouldn't hear if you were sitting there and they were trying to give you the story. You know, you picked up body language. You picked up how they communicated with each other. It was very, very helpful and important. And then over time, once I was more sure-footed in there, I did start to have conversations that might confirm what I thought I was trying to do so that I would not make any horrendous mistakes. Any mistakes I've said before, any mistakes I have made are clearly my own, totally my own, or were made maybe because of a novelistic decision, sure. A decision from an author to make it work.
Hmm. Well, you know, along those same lines, I was curious in reading how your experience as a journalist informed the writing of the novel, because I think, you know, I think journalists coming to fiction bring a certain ability to observe, to listen, to pick out to parse stories. I don't know. How do you think? Where do you think the crossover is?
You know, it's such a great question, because I've you know, sometimes I had to fight my journalistic, what I had learned as a journalist from a research perspective and getting to the meat of things perspective and understanding the story, and from the analysis part. I mean, when you were trying to figure out all the different pieces that could go into a story and then relay it, a good journalist is somebody who can sort of translate lots of things for an audience and so that they can then base opinions or action upon it. And in this situation, what I wanted was for my readers to feel, and not in a way that a journalist might make them do that, but by showing people actually playing it out. And it actually, this is where my years and years and years of a reader, I mean, I was an English major, and all those books read, and knowing how they worked really helped. I mean, I had to sort of blend the two. But I'll tell you, when my first few drafts, they looked like a journalist was doing them. They looked like, you know, they had the short paragraphs. I was struggling a bit with deviating from fact, especially when I was doing the research. But it's funny that the longer I worked at it, the more comfortable I got leaving that part behind and being grateful, frankly, for that training because of all the things that helped me do quickly to learn what I needed to learn. But once I separated the research part from the actual writing part, the journalism helped most, I think, with the research part.
Well, speaking of revision and mm-hmm. multiple drafts, how talk about that a little bit. You know, did you barrel through the first draft and then go through multiple drafts, getting, you know, different aspects right with the book? What did you do?
Oh, Barbara, there was no barreling. I wish I could say I could. But the fast first draft eluded me. Frankly, I think I'm going to be very honest. This book taught me how to write a novel. In many ways, I sat down and I wrote probably close to 1,000 pages of what, and only a portion of which survived into the third and fourth draft. You know, but I started with a character. I started with a basic idea, and then I struggled with the writing. Then I had a story that was going on and on and on. I had them traveling all over the country. I was just really trying to get my arms around it. And I think the writing took me to the story. So I think I wrote my way to the story, and it took a long time. But once I got to that draft where, okay, I know I have it, and it was a question of revising that, even then there were probably another, I think I was on version 6 when I finally submitted. No, that was the typeset version. I think I was in version 4 or 5 when I submitted to an agent and to the publisher.
I find that encouraging. I mean, you know, it's nothing, it's not anything a writer wants to hear, that you're going to have to write 1,000 pages before you get to the story. But I think it's the way it goes for the most part, don't you think?
Well, I'm not the only one, that's for sure. I mean, the one blessed thing that I have found once I started, realized, picked up my head, and realize there are other writers, you know, struggling with all these issues. And, you know, I'm a fortunate member of some good writing groups and organizations. You know that that is part of the deal. Some people do exactly what you suggested, which is get that first draft out. And that's my hope for my next novel, actually, is to try to move that first draft out faster. I keep thinking that I'll have learned enough to do that. Because you know all the revisions are still coming, and you want to be able to have that clay to work with sooner, you know. But at the same time, I think I really was on the hunt with this particular story. I was really mining for the ultimate story. And that took pages. That took the time.
So, yeah, I don't know if it's that you have a journalistic background and a business background, and you know sort of about the business, about mm-hmm. business in general. But I found it interesting that you have a publicist, and that I learned about your book through your publicist, and I take it that Kim Dower is an outside publicist. Mm-hmm. I have no details about it, so I'm only guessing here. But, you know, I hear agents a lot talk about how important it is to have an outside publicist, and often writers don't want to pay for it. And yet, at the same time, this is how I might have heard about your book anyway, but you know, mm-hmm. Kim brought it right before me and said, "How about this one?" Mm-hmm. And and I said, "Yeah, I like this one." Will you talk a little bit about that and your decision to do that?
Yes, I will. I consider it a very wonderful, you know, thing to be able to do this with Kim. And actually what I really love about how it's all worked out is I have a wonderful team situation. We have a good team, an editor and a publicist at my publisher who work, and Kim all work really well together. And that was the big revelation for me. I thought, oh, if I go outside, how will that be? You know, how will that work? You know, and get the little extra help. And what I'm finding is that we're all part of the team. I do things, they do things, everybody has their area of expertise, and everybody's willing to work together. And it was a wonderful, wonderful discovery for me, and I'm very grateful for it. The decision to do it, you know, when you work as long as I have on this novel, and it was a family decision to some degree. You know, we looked at this book, and, you know, he's going to hate this, but I'm going to say, you know, my husband was a huge partner for me in this decision. He doesn't like any attention at all, but but he's been huge in terms of this, because he was the one who said, you know, he encouraged me a few years back to say, okay, go for it. And so I stopped taking consulting work, and I went for it. And that's what closed the deal in terms of getting the book done. Mm-hmm. And then the same attitude prevailed when we sat down and said, what can we do to make sure that this gets the best chance it can get to reach as many readers as we can? Because I'd really like, you know, one of the things I'm really loving is when somebody reads the book and then writes me an email or tells me what they thought of it. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I'd love to get it to as many people as I can, because it sparks a kind of conversation that they didn't expect to be having, you know, not just about the writing, but about the story, you know, and what it's about. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are appreciating that, and I'm very gratified by that, because that's one of the things I'd hoped for. So I think having Kim on board has been a huge part of how all that's happening. And so I'm very grateful. And I guess when you say that authors are reluctant to do it, I think a lot of it really, frankly, is the, you know, it's investment. It's really important. It's hard. They have to make a big decision and advances these days. And I'll speak, you know, from my experience only. They're not what they used to be. So you're on the hook for a lot of the risk, you know, going forward. And I think that's a hard thing, you know.
Mm. We have so much more to talk about. Unfortunately, you're going to be at the Pen on Fire Speaker Series on Tuesday night.
Looking forward to it.
That will be wonderful. I have so many more questions. But as we end here, do you have any advice or last words for the writers listening that might help them along their way?
Well, I'm going to repeat some advice that I gave at the Southern California's Writers Conference just a few weeks ago, and that was basically it adds up to don't give up. Really, don't give up. It doesn't matter who, you know, when you start, or what's gone beyond, all the time you've wasted or think you have prior. Just start where you are, and if you fail, start again, because if this is what you're meant to be doing, that will rapidly become clear to you, and you won't be able to do anything else comfortably if you're not doing it. So that's my basic thought.
That's good. And let's give your website, ElizabethMorrow.com.
Correct.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'll be seeing you Tuesday night.
Wonderful, Barbara. It'll be a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was Elizabeth Morrow. Her novel is Casualties, published by Berkeley. Stay with us. We will be right back with T. Jefferson Parker. Don't go away. I can't see to write my own life.
someone said, and I've been out on my own ever since I was 10. Yes, I want to tell you, all on a bad sign. Yes, I would. And down since I began to crawl, y'all. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no kind of. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no kind of luck. If it wasn't for real. I can't see to ride my whole life, and I've been one big fight. Hard luck and trouble been my only friends. Been out on my own ever since I was 10. More than a bad sign. I'm gonna tell him. And down since I began to crawl, yo. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no kind of. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no kind of luck. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no luck at all. I'm gonna say that. Man, I don't want you. Part right here is for the fantastic, the fabulous, and the famous Mr. Albert King. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no kind of luck. If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know, when I had no kind of luck. If it wasn't for real.
I know you told me such a long time ago. Yes, you didn't love me, you didn't want me no more. It makes me weak. I think I'm a fool for you. Yes, I'm a fool for you. I know you told me you didn't want me around. Got another woman way across town. So it's something. Oh, honey, it makes me be. Would you believe me, daddy? I'm a fool for you. Yes, I'm a fool for you. Now wait a minute. Did you ever wake up in the morning? Just about to break a day. Look over at your pillow, where your baby used to lay. Then you put on your pride.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. Hi, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My first guest was Elizabeth Morrow, and my guest right now is T. Jefferson Parker. He is a loyal guest and supporter of the show and has written many novels and short stories, including the crime classic Laguna Heat, made into the movie by HBO. His Silent Joe and California Girl both won the coveted Edgar Award for Best Mystery, making Jeff one of only three authors to have won that award more than once. He lives with his family in Southern California, and he's here to talk about his newest novel, Crazy Blood, published by St. Martin's. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on again. I always love talking to you, and I am so enjoying this book and would love to hear you introduce it and talk about how it came about.
Okay, I'm happy to. Just a brief note, I wanted to tell you and your audience that I just finished Elizabeth Morrow's Casualties, and it's a wonderful novel, very
yes.
moving and beautifully done. So a shout-out to Elizabeth for that. The book that I'm, it will be published for me next week, March 8th, is my 22nd novel, and it's called Crazy Blood. And it, in short, it's a story about two half-brothers who are ferociously competing for a spot on the United States Olympic ski cross team. It takes place in Mammoth Lakes, California, where they were both born and raised. And it is a book in which I was able to explore the interesting combination of nature and nurture that goes into human beings through these two half-brothers that I explore. And it's also about going downhill really fast on skis, which terrifies me, and it's also about falling in love. So it's a big kind of a capacious story of competition and half-brothers in ski racing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think I've read all of your published novels, and so now it's like I see certain themes sort of emerging, and one of them is that of brothers, and usually there's one good and one not so good, and how they affect each other, and of course how they affect the plot of the novel. Will you comment on that and specifically talk about Sky and Wiley in this novel?
Yeah, sure, sure. I've always been fascinated by the idea that brothers, brother and sister, brother, one family, similar circumstances of growing up, can turn out so differently. I think it's a real eye opener when you see how different brothers and sisters can be. And concomitantly, I've always been, maybe because of that, I've always been drawn to the sort of, you know, atavistic, basic, real kind of, you know, Old Testament stories of brothers. You know, Cain and Abel rang and resonated with me as a boy, and Jacob and Esau, and these stories about brothers, and often it seems in stories like that, you know, one brother will be for no good reason, sort of blessed by his God, and the other brother, for no good reason, will be cursed. And I'm really interested in the way that we all of us, I think, enter the world with blessings and curses, and what we make of them, and how we are able to try to determine our fate in the face of those things that we are given at birth, and in face of the things that are hurled at us as we live our years.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess, you know, it also goes into creating conflict, which every novel needs, right?
Oh, sure, sure. No end to that.
Your novels also have strong matriarchs. I just reread Pacific Beat again, one of my favorites of yours, and has a strong mother figure, as Crazy Blood does. Will you talk about that, too?
Yeah, happy to. I think you know, I've certainly run across a lot of strong women in my life, beginning with my mom, who was a very strong woman and not stoic, but non-complaining, a real hard worker, and a real true lover without overt, huge shows of emotion. She was a subtle, great, loving mom. And she did a billion things for all of us three kids, you know, one of which for me was to, you know, read me stories when I was sitting on her lap at the age of 3 and 4, which I still remember vividly. And so anyway, the strong woman is no stranger to me, and so I like to pass that along. I mean, you can certainly, you know, twist, you know, strength and positive attitude into all sorts of strange places. Mm-hmm. In Crazy Blood, for instance, you know, the matriarch is a murderer, as she tells you on the very first page. She shot and killed her husband 25 years ago, mm-hmm. and she's done her time, and she's convicted, and she's done her time, and she's returned finally to this little town, Mammoth Lakes, where she grew up. And so, you know, the question of whether or not Cynthia is going to grow into a more more capacious and more reasonable and more loving person, having done what she did to her husband, remains to be seen, and that's one of the the plot threads of the story, if you will, is what's going to happen to Cynthia when the story is done.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about that beginning, because yeah, it begins with Cynthia recounting a crime of passion that took place many years prior, and I was curious if that was always the beginning, if you always kind of if that kicked off the book for you from the start.
Yeah, kind of did. You know, I thought a long, long time about where to start this book, because I knew the basic story of the half-brothers competing for the spot on the ski cross team, the small town, the kind of trial race, the enmity between them, the building of threats and bluffs and all that kind of thing, and sort of spiraling towards a possible tragedy at the end. I knew all that, but I didn't know where to start. I didn't know where to start the thing, you know, because where you start a novel is just so important. And I didn't want to start with these young men sort of bickering in a coffee shop or screaming at each other in a bar or something like that. I wanted to start with a larger kind of a perspective, and I thought, you know, the mom who kills the father of both of these boys, she's the one I want to hear from first. And so I open the book in her voice. It's a first-person voice. Cynthia's telling you her version of the story. And once I kind of set up the mountain, the competition, the murder of the father, then I was able to move into the more particular characters and see what they're up to. So Cynthia's literally a framing device, and she's a voice that I needed to bring my readers to the mountain, if you will.
And I like the mix here of point of view. You know, most of it's in third person, I believe, with the other characters, and Cynthia's first person. And was that also a plan from the start?
Yeah. I thought it was important to tell Cynthia's story in Cynthia's words. And I enjoy mixing up the viewpoint and the voice sometimes in my books. I've done that a lot. Some of them I'm very straightforward, and I just have one sort of viewpoint voice, third or first person, whatever it might be. But I thought a mix and a brew would be nice here, because it's a family novel in a lot of ways. And I have a grandfather and a missing son, mm-hmm. murdered son, and then two grandsons and the mother, Cynthia. And I thought it would be nice to give them moments, kind of equal moments, if you will. And I thought that Cynthia's kind of crazed voice would be kind of the glue that would open this book and hold it together. She's also the one who kind of has the last word.
I'd love to hear you read from Crazy Blood.
Okay. I got a section here that I'd like to read that takes place around Sky Carson, the antagonist. He's 26. He's a pro skier. For most of his life, he's suffered bouts of severe depression and physical pain that goes with it, kind of with increasing frequency as he gets older. And his antidote to this depression and these bouts is that he gets off alone to a little tiny cabin out in the desert off of 395, where there's no one around, and he rants and he raves and he suffers and he sweats and he throws himself around for 3 or 4 days. And finally, when he feels better, he goes back to the real world, which is Mammoth Lakes, California, where he lives. And he's out there in the desert in this scene, and he is with Megan, his girlfriend's little Jack Russell Terrier, Ivan the Terrier, who is a very typical terrier, as you'll see. He takes Ivan out there for company. So this is Sky out in the desert trying to beat back his depression, the only way that he's ever done it.
Okay.
The first night wasn't too bad. Just a lot of trembling and not much sleep and night sweats that soaked his T-shirt and briefs. Then the eerie awakening to a new day with the black knot fully upon him. Oh, I should say, the black knot is what he calls his depression. He has a name for it, and it's a noun, and it's the black knot, N-O-T. So anyway, then the eerie awakening to a new day with the black knot fully within him, tightening down his vision, tensing up his muscles, multiplying the pain. And the worst of it really wasn't the pain, but the hopelessness the black knot brought. That was the knot part, the utter impossibility of all that was good. The black knot poisoned all his hope and optimism, all his dreams and wishes, all in his father's voice. Not, no, never. That morning, he walked Ivan into the desert on his leash. It was easy to imagine the dog taking off after a rabbit and never coming back. Terrier fearlessness was a threat to their survival. Megan would be crushed if something happened to Ivan, and Sky loved Megan. The October weather was mild. He poked around up on the hillside where the copper ore tailing shined in the sun, picked up a few warm, pale blue rocks for Megan. The pain had spread. While standing on a low hillock, the arches of his feet suddenly cramped, as they often did, just knotted right up like fists. Sky gasped and dropped to his butt and tore at the laces of his hiking boots. How could a foot arch hurt that much? When he'd gotten the boots off, he used both hands to unclench one cramp, then the other. It was like trying to unbend metal. Then the first arch locked tight again. Ivan seized the opportunity and ran. Sky foresaw coyotes. He ordered Ivan back, but the dog tore off along the bottom of the hillock, leash bouncing along behind him, apparently fixed on something that Sky couldn't see. Sky tried to run a few steps, but the rocks were brutally sharp, so he high-stepped back and plopped down and got the boots on as fast as he could. But the long laces kept falling out of the so-called speed hooks, so by the time he finished, the boots looked like they had been laced by a chimpanzee. Sky ran around the base of the hill. Ivan was out of sight, but Sky heard his barking and understood that the dog was soon going to die here in some painful and gruesome way. It was the only thing that could happen. He slipped and fell, and this did not surprise him because the black knot only allowed him pessimism, defeat, pain, and death. Even an appreciation of beauty, like a sunrise, say, or gratefulness for sudden good luck, or the genuine joy in a glass of cold, clean water, all of this was forbidden by the black knot, banished. Only black, only knot. Sky rounded the hillock and saw Ivan out 100 yards ahead, barking furiously at a pack of bony stray dogs closing in on him in a rambling, low-snouted fashion. But Ivan's leash had miraculously caught between some rocks. Without this restraint, he would probably have already raced to his own death, but Sky saw no good fortune in the snagged leash. All he could envision was Ivan stuck there and unable to run, soon to be torn to ribbons and devoured by the marauders. "Torn to ribbons right in front of you," said his father's voice. Sky didn't think he'd ever get there, and then he was there, grabbing the snagged loop end of the leash without stopping or even slowing down. But when he took up the leash, a weird slackness greeted him, and the collar came hopping back along the rocky ground toward him, while newly freed Ivan sped in the other direction toward the dog. "Ivan, no!" Sky put everything he had into the sprint. Running was such a crude, slow thing compared to downhill skiing. He yelled as loudly as he could, hoping to frighten or confuse the dog. Ivan was fast, but suddenly he stopped, cocked his ears, and looked silently at the pack moving up the arroyo toward him. Sky dug in, knowing he'd trip and fall on the sharp rocks, cut his knees badly enough for stitches, maybe even lacerate or crush both patellas, which would ruin his workouts for weeks and reduce his Mammoth Cup chances from slim to none. Of course, he would mess everything up. Before Sky knew it, Ivan was in his arms, solid and squirming wildly. Sky tucked him against his side like a football and kept charging toward the pack, hollering. The dog stopped and waited a moment, ears and tails up, before splitting off in half-hearted sideways retreats. Sky stopped, clutching Ivan fast and watching the dogs, which watched him and Ivan as they blended into the desert.
Thank you so much. That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from Crazy Blood, published by St. Martin's next Tuesday, March 8th. There's so much to talk about here. Fortunately, you're going to be at the speaker series next Tuesday, and I don't have to feel like I have to fit it all in now. But
oh, right.
Let's talk a little bit about setting. I love the way you write about setting. I love your mammoth, all your mammoth stuff. It actually made me want to return there. So I started looking into I have to go. When can I go up there? You weave it in seamlessly. Do you have any rules for writing setting?
Gosh, I love setting. I'm such a sucker for it. You know, it's always been geography and town. Yeah, geography and cities, towns have always been a big inspiration. You know, all the way back 30 plus years ago to Laguna Heat. You know, half of what inspired Laguna Heat was Laguna Beach, where I had just moved after growing up right over the hill in Tustin.
Mm-hmm.
Laguna seemed so exotic to me. And a lot of my books have been very much inspired by the setting. Mammoth, unmistakably, inspired a lot of this book. And, I just try to get it right, and I try to get the feel for the setting or the town. And I try not to overdose my reader in overly detailed histories or nuances about a place, but just kind of get the core of the place, the feeling, Laguna Beach and, Mammoth or Fallbrook. They're all so different. You know, they're all California small towns, but they're all so very different. And all the time that I have spent in Laguna, for instance, or Fallbrook, where I've lived for 16 years now, or Mammoth, where I've been going to fish mainly for 20 years, all those hours and all the time spent in those towns, I think it comes into the book some way that you don't even necessarily, you're not even aware of, you don't really see. It's not even research at that point. It's just kind of being a part of what's going on around you, and there's a kind of a nice feeling of I hope, kind of relaxed authenticity that comes with the setting. And that's what I appreciate as a reader. You know, when I pick up a book and it's firmly on the ground in time and place, I'm so relieved that I don't have to struggle to figure out, the basics of stuff. And so I try to supply those. It's like setting the stage almost.
Mm. And all your details about skiing, too. Did you have to do any research for that? I mean, it was like so meticulously researched, it felt like, and yet made me think that, of course, you were the expert skier and you brought everything you knew into your fiction from your own experience.
That's funny. It's funny you should ask. The advice that all young writers always get in every writing program ever held on the face of the earth is write what you know. You know, I always say write what you know. But I'm going to change that. Instead of writing what I knew in this book, I wrote what scared me. I wrote what terrified me.
Mm.
And I'm a terrible skier. The only reason I ever got on skis in my 50s, mind you, was to help my two sons learn the basics of going down a mountain on skis, because it was something I never learned as a youngster and always kind of wanted to know. You know, I always mm-hmm. wished that I'd been able to ski, and I'd put it off doing other things. And so I came to it very late in life, and I was immediately able to appreciate, what a little bit of speed can do on a steep mountain on snow with these giant boards, latched to your boots, it's really quite a thing. And so I did a lot of research into ski cross racing and downhill ski racing. I talked to the Mammoth ski team guys, the coaches and the director of the program, a couple of the competitors who actually do this kind of ski cross racing that I talk about in the book. And a lot of research, a lot of red stuff, a lot of interviews, and a lot of just sort of imagining, how crazy it must be to be going downhill that fast with three other guys right clustered around you trying to get to the finish line first, which is what ski cross racing is. So, tons of research into something that sort of scares me, and I wish I could ski a tenth as good as Wiley Welburn and Skye Carson in the book. I never will.
I love it. I love being brought into that world because I love snow and I miss it desperately. But anyway, a couple more minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about plot, because you're really sort of the master of plot. And I imagine after so many novels, you'd have it down by now. And can you recall the difference between plotting as a new writer and plotting now?
Let's see, plotting then and plotting now. Plotting out a novel is is really, really, really hard work. I think any novelist would tell you that. And, well, you know that. And it's difficult and it's time-consuming and there's no real trick or formula to it. I think that, you know, what I try to do now in terms of plot is to pack a lot into the story and sort of dense pack the story with incidents that are meaningful and fun to read and kind of let the plot develop out of that. I kind of write my way into the story like Elizabeth was talking about earlier. I have basic, you know, scenes that I know I want to write and moments I want to bring to the reader and a certain feeling that I want to impart on the reader. But, you know, how you're going to get there is always kind of a mystery. And my rule of thumb now is to never, ever write a scene, you know, hopefully not even a line, that just lays there inertly and doesn't entertain or instruct or you know, intrude upon the reader in some meaningful way. Try to make every line count, and I think somehow, in some weird way, that's how the plots develop. Like Crazy Blood is a very densely plotted book. It's a short book, relatively short. Scenes are fairly short and stuff, but the way that all the little details kind of connect, it's a very dense book in a lot of ways too. And I like that density in a book. I like dense plots, lots of subplots. It's fun.
Me too. We're at the end of our time. Any surprises in the writing of Crazy Blood?
Surprises, gosh. Well, yeah. I showed the manuscript to a couple of downhill ski racers, ski cross racers to be particular, and a ski cross coach up in Mammoth, and they said, "You did a good job capturing the ski racing." And that made me feel great because, as I said before, it's something that I'm completely foreign to. I have no knack for. And I was writing out of my league as far as personal experience goes. But somehow, if I can convince them, I can convince other people, I hope. That surprised me.
Yeah, you convinced me. Man, he's really gone into skiing up
there. That's funny.
Anyway, we'll talk more Tuesday night. It'll be good to see you and talk more about Crazy Blood and see you at the speaker series. Thank you.
Good, Barbara. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
That was T. Jefferson Parker. His new book is Crazy Blood, published by St. Martin's. And Elizabeth and he will be at the Pen on Fire speaker series on Tuesday night. You can find out more at penonfire.com. We're at the end of our time, and I'm going to leave you now. Next week, I think Marie will be back with a couple of wonderful authors who wrote wonderful books. Visit us. In the meantime, stay in the chair, keep writing, and be well.